Hello, this is Randy Thompson from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to Music Review. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. For the next half hour, I shall be reading articles about music from such sources as the New York Times, the News and Observer, the Week Magazine, Rolling Stone, and Entertainment Weekly. Music Review is designed to provide the latest coverage of classical folk, jazz, blues, rock, country, and pop music news. But first, these musical trivia questions. Today's musical trivia questions come to us from the website onthisday.com. Question number one. It was on this very day back in 1957 that Buddy Knox became the first artist in the rock and roll era to write his own number one hit. What was the title of this tune that Buddy Knox wrote, recorded, and rode to number one on the charts on this day back in 1957? Was it A, Party Doll, B, Rock Around the Clock, C, Chantilly Lace, or D, At the Hop? 1957? Buddy Knox? So, name that tune. And question number two, it was on this very day back in 1943 that the musical Oklahoma by Rodgers and Hammerstein debuted on Broadway. What was the original title of this famous musical? Was it A, Away We Go, B, Surrey with the Fringe, C, Dust Bowl Memories, or D, Curly's Revenge? So, what was the original title of this famous musical that ran for over 15 years, 2,212 performances on Broadway? The answers to these two important musical trivia questions will be given, as usual, at the end of today's program. Our transitions come to us from that same website, onthisday.com, and today, quote-unquote, is the weekend of March the 30th. Well, it was on this day back in 1732 that composer Franz Joseph Haydn was born. He is known for helping to develop the classical style. And it was 141 years after Haydn's birth, in 1873, on this very day, that another famous classical composer, Sergei Rachmaninoff, was born. And we'll be hearing more about this famous composer in the classical music section of today's program.
It's so damn easy to say that life's so hard. Everybody's got their share of battle scars. As for me, I'd like to thank my lucky stars that I'm alive and well.
Willie Nelson's I'm Alive introduces today's country music news entitled Hazel Smith, Country Music Journalist, Dies. This is published in Billboard.com on the 20th of March, 2018. Country music journalist, publicist, and songwriter Hazel Smith has died. She was 83. Smith is credited with coining the term outlaw country in the 1970s. She worked as a publicist for Kinky Friedman and worked out of Tom Paul Glazer's studio with artists like Waylon Jennings and Willie Nelson. And it was there she came up with the movement's moniker for artists who were bucking music row trends. She wrote a regular popular column for Country Music Magazine, as well as writing for other outlets, and had songs recorded by Tammy Wynette and Dr. Hook. She also worked with Ricky Skaggs and Sharon White and was the host of a CMT series, Southern Fried Flicks. A recent New York Times article added that this Nashville music industry matriarch coined the phrase outlaw country in order to describe the unvarnished alternative to mainstream country music. Her death at Skyline Medical Center was caused by heart failure.
Stars are dancing on the water here tonight. It's good for the soul when there's not a soul in sight. This boat has caught its wind.
Rachmaninoff's Rhapsody on a Theme of Paganini introduces today's classical music news entitled Rachmaninoff, 15 Facts About the Great Composer. This is published in ClassicFM.com. A brilliant pianist, conductor, and composer, Rachmaninoff wrote a piano concerto that has become the nation's favorite piece of classical music. So in celebration of his birthday this weekend, let's find out what these 15 facts are. Number 1. A young musical genius. Sergei Rachmaninoff was born on 1 April 1873 in Semyonovo, northwest Russia. As a young man, he consistently amazed his teachers with his jaw-dropping ability as a pianist and composer. He created a storm with his first piano concerto when he was just 18. Number 2, a drunken premiere. The premiere of Rachmaninoff's First Symphony in March of 1897 was a total disaster. It took place under the baton of Glazunov, who was at best incompetent and, according to some, drunk. The critics tore the work apart, and it was never again performed during Rachmaninoff's life. He fell into a depression and needed hypnosis to conquer that problem. Number 3, the nation's favorite classical work. Rachmaninoff's Piano Concerto No. 2 of 1901 is often described as the greatest ever written. Its subsequent use in the film, Brief Encounter, has made it a constant favorite. Number 4, Rachmaninoff and Daughter. It was after completing his first major choral work, Vesna, Spring, in 1902 that Rachmaninoff made the surprise announcement that he was marrying his cousin, Natalia. This caused something of a stir, as in Russia, first cousins weren't permitted to marry. But marry they did, and in May of 1903, their daughter, Irina, was born. Number 5, Rachmaninoff drawing. Rachmaninoff was not just a composer, but in his day he was a fine conductor and magnificent pianist. He was appointed principal conductor of the Bolshoi Theater in 1904 and was offered several major posts in the U.S., most notably with the Boston Symphony Orchestra. Number 6, a resounding success. Rachmaninoff composed his Symphony No. 2 in Dresden, where he and his family lived for the best part of 4 years from 1906. Writing the symphony was a daunting affair for the composer. However, it was a resounding success and has remained one of the most popular of all of his works. Number 7, enormous hands. The composer had possibly the largest hands in classical music, which is why some of his pieces are fiendishly difficult for less well-endowed performers. He could span 12 piano keys from the tip of his little finger to the tip of his thumb. Number 8, a shining hit. Rachmaninoff's very large hands came in useful when performing his third piano concerto. It's grander, fuller, and more expansive in tone and style than the second, with the soloist stretched to the very limits of his ability. The work is used powerfully on the soundtrack of the film Shine, and the success of the film ensured a new audience for this muscular, romantic work. Number 9, a man of faith. Rachmaninoff had a very deep and personal religious faith, which he expressed beautifully in 1915 through his unaccompanied set of choral vespers. They are separated into two parts, the evening vespers and the morning matins, both full of exquisitely rich harmonies. Number 10, Driven Out by the Russian Revolution. The 1917 Russian Revolution meant the end of Russia as the composer had known it. In December 1917, he left Petrograd for Helsinki on an open sled with his wife and daughters. Now in his 40s, Rachmaninoff launched a third, more lucrative strand of his career as a concert pianist. Number 11, America, the Future. Rachmaninoff saw America as the future, and from his arrival there in 1918, he found himself in great demand, so much so that composing became limited to the summer months. Things reached fever pitch in the 1922 through 23 concert season, when Rachmaninoff gave more than 70 performances between November and the end of March. He made enough money to build a house in Los Angeles that was an exact replica of his original Moscow home. Number 12, Lost in Music. Rachmaninoff was once giving a recital in New York with violinist Fritz Kreisler. Kreisler got into a muddle about where they were in the music. Panic-stricken, he whispered to Rachmaninoff, "Where are we?" The reply came back, "Carnegie Hall." Number 13, The Six-Foot Scowl. Despite his success, Rachmaninoff seldom smiled in photographs. Tall and severe, he was once dubbed a six-foot scowl. He did, however, have a passion for fast cars and later speedboats. He was the first in his neighborhood to have an automobile. Number 14, Final Recital. By the time of his final tour in 1943, Rachmaninoff was already seriously ill with lung cancer, brought on by a lifetime of heavy smoking. It seems almost prophetic that his final recital on 17 February 1943 included Chopin's famous funeral march. He died a month later in Beverly Hills, 4 days before his 70th birthday. And number 15, A Lasting Legacy. Only a decade after Rachmaninoff's death, the Grove Dictionary of Music and Musicians predicted that the enormous popular success some few of Rachmaninoff's works had in his lifetime is not likely to last, and musicians never regarded them with much favor, quote-unquote. They could not have been more wrong. And in music research and technology, we have this article entitled, What's the Deal with Music Copyright Law? Seinfeld Composer Speaks to Penn Law Students. This is written in the Daily Pennsylvanian on the 28th of February, 2018, by Albert Chenfeng Chao. Jonathan Wolff, the composer for 75 primetime network TV shows, including Seinfeld, talked to Penn students about how he used the law to further his career at an event on February 27th. Wolff, who proclaimed himself the quote-unquote busiest composer and busiest dealmaker in Hollywood, said his understanding of law had shaped his career and financial success as a musician. Before I had a business plan, studios treated me like a Swiss Army tool for musical chores. Anything that smelled like music, I did. But that's not a career, because every time the phone rang, I went in a different direction, and the phone told me which way to go, Wolf said. My highest-earning TV shows were paying out about the same amount as my losers were. Wolf said he later learned to navigate the industry with the help of his lawyer, an attorney with over 30 years of experience in the music business. Wolf said he found a legal loophole for him after he complained about the ways royalties work, allowing him to earn an amount that he actually deserved. That's what a good lawyer can do for a client. Listen to his problem, complaints, and do something about it, Wolf said. Students at the event said they appreciated Wolf's candor. In the hour-long event, Wolf described the inner workings of the Hollywood industry and his interactions with copyright law through licensing and royalty negotiations and disputes. He talked at length about what he had learned about contractual rights while creating scores for B-movies, many of which was often generic and reusable. I created a deal, a non-exclusive master license, which means I own the music, Wolf said, so I could use the same music for another movie. And this went on for 21 some odd pictures. All it took was a thimble full of talent and some contractual knowledge. That is what you can do for your clients, Wolf added. The article skips down and ends with this. His main message was to differentiate yourself from others, and he changed a couple of things in the industry, one of the students said. He talked a lot about his life and his business, but it would have been nice to hear some of his actual work. And also in Music Research and Technology, we have this from The Costco Connection, April 2018, entitled Music Master. Classical guitarist Gabriel Ayala can express feelings through his music that words cannot. I love sound. It's the epitome of passion, says the internationally renowned music maker, a member of the Pascua Yaqui tribe. Ayala has played for a pope, Benedict XVI, and a president, Barack Obama, in addition to performing with music icons like Carlos Santana as part of his more than 100 concerts a year. In between gigs, he hosts liner notes on radio station KPYT and teaches and performs for young people. Music is medicine, he explains. Having grown up poor on a southern Arizona reservation, he understands angst and despair and sets out to heal through the gift of sound, abiding by his mantra, honor elders, respect women, love children. I want to be a positive influence for youth, so I walk my talk. I'm drug, alcohol, and tobacco free, addicted only to my music, Ayala says. I don't play music for fame or status, but because it enriches life, it heals. Although Ayala earned a master's degree in music performance, he was not a child prodigy and needed to practice up to 15 hours a day. That dedication, that passion to be at the top of his field, continues to be his driving force. Despite performing around the world at diverse locales, such as the Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts and the National Museum of the American Indian, he has a natural modesty. On stage, he's the master. Off stage, I'm a man of prayer, a traditional singer, and a regular attendee at ceremonies that keep me grounded. This was written by Lee Allen.
Nibbling on sponge cake, watching the sun bake, all of those tourists covered with oil.
Jimmy Buffett's Margaritaville introduces today's rock and pop music news. This is published in The Week magazine, February 23rd, 2018. Jimmy Buffett's Type A Personality. Jimmy Buffett is no longer living the Jimmy Buffett lifestyle, said Taffy Brodesser Ackner in the New York Times. The Margaritaville singer is now 71 and has cut way back on his sweet signature drink. I don't do sugar anymore, he said. No sugar and no carbs, except on Sunday. Buffett has never really been the devil-may-care beach bum his music would suggest. It took a keen business sense to turn Margaritaville, the song, into Margaritaville, the global brand which he oversees in minute detail, complete with branded shirts, pool floats, restaurants, hotels, and even a Margaritaville adult living community. Buffett learned early on as a music journalist that he needed to control his own intellectual property or be forever at the mercy of the record companies. It was indentured servitude, he says. In 1999, Buffett started his own record label so that he could make $6 an album instead of $2.20, and took over merchandising to ensure quality. It's up to you to figure out how to take advantage, he says. I think it was just the way I was brought up in a seafaring family. I wanted to be in charge, like a captain of the boat.
Now I think, hell, it could be my fault.
Hey, Scooters, it's your leader, BMR and WMCA, jumping in with my hat in my hand with the nuttiest show on the entire New York turf, reacting to the Smashbacks or on the Good Guys Survey or headed that way. This hour, the name of the winner of the Musical Love Letters Contest, first portion being presented from the lobby of the Nile Hilton Hotel. A name claim style will go to Connecticut. Second call, Vinny Blah, Plaza 25,000, and like that there, Schmier. Call right now.
1963's B. Mitchell Reed, a radio DJ from New York City's WMCA, introduces our local music news. This is written by Catherine Curran and published in Walter Magazine, March 2018 issue. People see you loading a sound system to a party and they're fired up, according to DJ Joe Bunn. Joe Bunn is part of a soundtrack of Raleigh. You might have heard the local DJ at a wedding or a corporate event, or perhaps at a spin class at Flywheel or Cycle Bar. Bunn first got the mixing bug at age 13, playing for parties in his hometown of Wilson, North Carolina. He tried a brief stint on the drums, too, but found it wasn't his jam. He had to get more creative if he wanted to pursue music, he says. From an early age, I realized that, since I loved music but wasn't a very good musician, this was the natural progression of things. At least, I'd be able to play music. From Wilson, Bunn's turntables moved to teen clubs, to fraternity basements at his alma mater, UNC Chapel Hill, and then to beach bars in Wilmington. It wasn't until he moved to Raleigh in 2000, he says, that he realized he could spin records full-time. I started making it more than just a one-man show. Today, Bunn DJ Company includes dozens of DJs in Charlotte, Charleston, South Carolina, and Richmond, Virginia, as well as in Raleigh. DJing is fun in games, he says, but for Bunn, it's a lifestyle, too. In addition to his gigs, he sells custom turntables, and he records his own weekly podcast, the PhDJ Podcast. He's also gotten his son, Colin, 12, interested in the music. Bunn is an educational speaker, and he says up next, he'll be in Las Vegas this month at the Mobile Beat Conference. I speak more about business than DJing. I'll speak about how I find and hire talent and how I built this business. Yeah, it just seemed to call for a drum roll. So how'd you do on today's musical trivia questions? Well, the answer to our first question, it was on this very day back in 1957 that Buddy Knox became the first artist in the rock and roll era to write his own number one hit. What was the title of this tune that Buddy Knox wrote, recorded, and rode to number one on the charts on this very day back in 1957? Was that A, Party Doll, B, Rock Around the Clock, C, Chantilly Lace, or D, At the Hop? 1957, Buddy Knox. So, name that tune. Correct answer is answer A, Party Doll. As noted in songfacts.com, Buddy Knox wrote the original verses of this song in 1948 behind a haystack on his Texas family farm. The rockabilly singer got together with some college friends to record the tune several years later at the Clovis, New Mexico studio of Norman Petty. Just 1,500 copies of the record were pressed, but when a DJ in Amarillo began playing the tune in 1956, Party Doll soon became a regional hit. The record was picked up by Morris Levy's Roulette label in New York and given a national release, following a memorable rendition by Buddy Knox and his group on the Ed Sullivan Show. The song topped radio playlists coast to coast and rose to the top of the top 100 chart. And the answer to our second question, it was on this very day, back in 1943, that the musical Oklahoma by Rodgers and Hammerstein debuted on Broadway. What was the original title of this famous musical? Was it A, Away We Go, B, Surrey with the Fringe, C, Dust Bowl Memories, or D, Curly's Revenge? So what was the original title of this famous musical that ran for 2,212 performances on Broadway? That's over 15 years. Correct answer, answer A, Away We Go. As noted in NewsOK.com 75 years ago today, the curtain rose on a new production that would literally change the course of the American musical theater. Named in honor of the 46th U.S. state, Oklahoma, would also launch the durable partnership of Richard Rodgers and Oscar Hammerstein II. Rodgers' former partner, Lorenz Hart, thought Green Grow the Lilacs, the Lynn Riggs play on which Oklahoma was based, too homespun to be successful as a musical. Clearly, it was far better suited to Hammerstein, a lyricist known for his successes in operetta. Until the musical had reached Boston, Oklahoma was known as Away We Go. But when a full harmony arrangement of what had once been a solo tap feature brought down the house night after night, Hammerstein suggested adding an exclamation point to the song's title and be done with it. Its 2,212 performance run would become the team's longest-running musical. It also set an 18-year record that endured until My Fair Lady surpassed it. Away We Go makes an appropriate closing title to Music Review, so here we go.
Oklahoma, when the wind comes sweeping down the plain, and the waving wheat can sure smell sweet when the wind comes right behind the rain. Oklahoma, every night my honey lamb and I sit alone and talk and watch a hawk making lazy circles in the sky.
Oh, well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Music Review. And as we leave you, remember these words. Kindness is a language which blind people see and deaf people hear. Be sure to tune in at the same time next week. I'm Randy Thompson, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Music Review is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast in the TRRS website, TriangleReadingService.org. Now, if you have a suggestion for music to feature on this program, please leave a message for me, Randy Thompson at 919-832-5138. So long, until next time.
And the land we belong to is grand. Yippee, 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 yippee.